Broom Factory with Fortunato Duretti Marnetti. On November 8th, don't miss Shania Twink, your favorite all-queer femme country and pop cover band. On November 20th, Canadian rock and roll powerhouse JJ Wild comes back to town. And on November 25th, hip-hop icon Classified with support from Rhea May take the stage at The Broom. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com. See you at the shows.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we bring you Chapter 1 of our next major investigative series, The Kopernik Affair.
Everybody agrees on the basic facts of what happened that night in Paris back in 1980, and that it was an awful tragedy. But what they don't agree on is who was behind the attack. There's the French story that Hassan Diab is a convicted murderer living freely in Ottawa.
When you see that the guy is lying, you know that he's guilty.
And then there's the story we've been told in Canada, that he's an innocent man, a father, a husband, a well-liked professor, and a great friend.
He's a great cook. He's very sociable. He's a wonderful person.
Wait for it. We have a Google alert set for the name Hassan Diab, for reasons that I'll soon explain. Anytime that name, Hassan Diab, pops up in the press, we get a notification. And for months, there was almost nothing. Last week, that changed. Daily Mail UK, November 8th, 2024. Here's the headline. Canadian University's new professor is convicted Islamist synagogue bomber who killed four. Jerusalem Post, November 4th. Spitting on the graves of Jewish victims. Terrorist to teach social justice at Canadian University. Terrorist, Islamist, bomber, Hassan Diab. Other people have a different word for him. Scapegoat. And the reason why we have a Google alert set up for his name is because we have been investigating his case for the last year. And even before his name popped up in the news last week, we were planning on bringing you Chapter 1 of our new series about him, The Kopernik Affair, today. Funny timing. Here's a bit of the story behind the story. Over a year ago, we received a pitch from two exceptional investigative journalists. Dana Balut, a Lebanese-American reporter who has worked for The Wall Street Journal, for This American Life, and for Kerning Cultures. And Alex Atak, a British journalist who works for The Guardian. They brought our attention to a Canadian story that I have to admit I had never heard about before. The case of Hassan Diab, a sociology professor in Ottawa who in 2007 found himself accused of bombing the Rue Kopernik Synagogue in Paris in 1980, an attack that killed four people. Diab vigorously denies that he ever did this. He has been convicted for it. And yet, he is a free man, living a quiet life in Ottawa. A free man who is willing to sit down with Dana and Alex for as long as it took. And it took a lot more than that. For the past year, my colleagues, Noor Azria and Julie Shapiro and me, we've been working with Dana and Alex as they conducted the most in-depth journalistic investigation into the Kopernik Synagogue bombing and into the case of Hassan Diab that anyone has attempted. Dana and Alex got their hands on documents that nobody has ever reported on. They secured interviews with people who have never come forward before to share what they know about this. They have traveled the globe looking for information that would help them answer the central question of our series. Is Hassan Diab a terrorist, or is he a scapegoat? And in a moment, you will hear the first episode of this series. And I think that what you're about to hear is so much more than those angry headlines in the Daily Mail and the Jerusalem Post. This is the whole story. And stories that are as complex and as important as this one, they need to be told in full. But we are not actually releasing the whole story. We're not releasing the whole series until January. All right. Here then is The Kopernik Affair, Chapter 1.
If you could just introduce yourself, Oren, just tell me your name and who you are.
So my name is Oren Shagrir. I'm from Jerusalem. I was born here in Jerusalem 63 years ago. I guess that I'm here to talk about the Kopernik Affair, the terror attack in which my mother was killed in 1980.
October 3rd, 1980, Paris, France.
My mother was just a tourist in Paris.
Her name was Aliza Shagrir. She was a film editor. Aliza was in Paris with Oren's brother. The two of them were on their way to meet a family friend when she stopped off at a grocery store on Kopernik Street, a quiet street in an affluent neighborhood in the west of the city.
Then my mother, when they arrived to the corner of Kopernik and Lauriston, my mother told my brother that she will just go to the fruit store on Kopernik Street to bring some figs and that she will meet my brother in a few minutes. But this was the last time my brother saw her.
There's a well-known synagogue on Kopernik Street. It's the oldest Reform synagogue in France, built in 1907. And on that Friday evening, the start of Sabbath, worshippers were beginning to file in before the service was due to start. Pascal, who was 13 at the time, was amongst them.
C'était un jour normal, c'était le vendredi soir, le jour du Shabbat, donc on allait à l'office, j'étais avec mon frère, et après...
He told us it was a normal day. He was with his brother. Their parents, who would usually come too, were hosting a small party that evening, so they stayed home.
Et ce soir-là, mes parents ne sont pas venus, ils sont restés chez eux, ils avaient une soirée.
By the time everyone had arrived, there were more than 300 people gathered inside. There were prayers and songs, then a few bar and bat mitzvahs to celebrate. So things were running longer than usual.
Then, at around 6:30 p.m., Pascal heard this sound. He felt the ground trembling. Shards of glass fell from the windows above him.
Moi, je pensais que c'était la fin du monde, que c'était voilà un événement naturel, que c'était la colère. En fait, en plus dans une synagogue, moi j'étais en train.
Pascal first thought that this was an earthquake, that it might be the end of the world.
Et donc au moment de l'explosion, tout le plafond s'est écroulé et le plafond vert, donc les personnes qui étaient.
Parts of the ceiling crumbled, pieces of the wall were blown off, dust and debris everywhere.
Et il y avait un rideau de flammes qui séparait la synagogue de la rue.
He remembers seeing a curtain of flames rising between the synagogue and the street. And outside, there was chaos.
L'explosion a eu lieu aux alentours de 18h45 à la synagogue israélite libérale de la rue Copernic, au numéro 24 de cette rue Copernic.
A bomb had been detonated right outside the synagogue's front doors. Journalists rushed to the scene. Annette Lévy-Willard from the newspaper Libération was one of them.
It was a war zone. People running, people crying, blood all over, corpses. It was for me, for the first time in my life, that I was facing dead people.
In the chaos afterward, the rabbi told a reporter that he saw at least two people dead. He'd later learn that there were more.
Une bombe qui s'est explosée avec une violence inouïe. Il y avait 300 ou 400 personnes dans la synagogue et j'ai vu dans la rue au moins deux personnes mortes. Au moins une personne absolument morte et plusieurs personnes grièvement blessées.
The timing of the bomb was no doubt intentional. Around 6:30 p.m. is when people should have been leaving the synagogue and heading home. Had things run on time, a lot more people could have been hurt. Still, four people were killed by the blast.
Jean Barbe, a chauffeur, waiting in his car.
Philippe Puissou, a young student riding past on his motorbike, going to meet his fiancée.
Hilario Lopez Fernandez, a hotel concierge, standing on the sidewalk.
And Oren's mom, Aliza Shagrir.
They woke me up very early in the morning of the day after, yeah, and told me. She was 42 when she was killed. She was beautiful, joyful, very opinionated. In some ways, she was the center of the family. Especially, I think, her warmth and empathy, because as a child, she was the more dominant parent in the house, taking care of us. I missed this for many years.
Dozens more people were injured in the explosion. A teenager's face was completely disfigured. An elderly woman's legs were severed.
And I wondered for many years, why did these people choose to hit the Copernic synagogue? And I was really wondering why? Why?
For France's Jewish community, there was a time before the Copernic attack and a time after. Anti-Semitism hadn't gone away after World War II, but outright direct violence targeted at Jews seemed like a thing of the past. What happened on Copernic Street shattered that. In the aftermath, the city was in a state of shock, and police were under immense pressure to find out who orchestrated this attack. But shock soon transformed into paralysis. For decades, it seemed like the perpetrator had gotten away with the bombing.
Parce que vous avez un ennemi invisible qui veut votre mort sans que vous compreniez.
Pascal told us it was like living with an invisible enemy. Someone had tried to kill them, but that someone was a ghost. I'm Dana Balut.
I'm Alex Atak.
From Canada Land, this is the Copernic Affair.
Dana and I are journalists. We first met in Lebanon, where we both used to live, and we've worked together for years since, which is partly why this story caught our eye in the first place. Because years later, when French investigators finally did identify their prime suspect, it turned out he was a Lebanese man, a sociology professor, living a quiet life in Ottawa, Canada.
To have a terrorist in our midst, in quiet old Ottawa, I was actually disgusted.
But when we first heard about this case, we thought, there's got to be more to this story. So we started reporting and ended up speaking to dozens of people in Canada and in France, some of whom had never talked about this in public before.
My brother asked me, do you know Professor Hassan Diya? And I said, I know him very well. What's wrong? He said, this morning he was arrested.
What we found the whole time we've been working on this story is that it's felt like we're actually working on two different stories in parallel.
How could anything like this happen to somebody like him?
You're getting a bit emotional.
I am, yeah.
Everybody agrees on the basic facts of what happened that night in Paris back in 1980, and that it was an awful tragedy.
It was a tremendous shock in Paris because it was the first time since maybe 30 years that a bomb attack was perpetrated in the streets of Paris.
But what they don't agree on is who was behind the attack. There's the French story that Hassan Diab is a convicted murderer living freely in Ottawa.
When you see that the guy is lying, you know that he's guilty.
And then there's the story we've been told in Canada, that he's an innocent man, a father, a husband, a well-liked professor, and a great friend.
He's a great cook. He's very sociable. He's a wonderful person.
It's a legal battle that has reached the highest courts in both countries.
There's such strong evidence of his innocence that just has consistently been ignored by, you know, both the French and Canadian governments.
World leaders have weighed in.
Hassan Diab, we have to recognize, first of all, that what happened to him never should have happened.
Investigators have spent decades looking for a culprit.
I believe he was being targeted because the French needed a scapegoat.
But despite all this, 45 years later, the story of the Copernic synagogue bombing is still unfolding.
It's a movie you couldn't even imagine writing the script of because it's so hard to believe, but it's reality.
So we got in touch with a man convicted of carrying out this attack. We were curious to see if he would talk to us. So we are almost at Hassan's house. This is our second day. He said yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm just walking along Rue Köpenick now, Köpenick Street. Early in our reporting, I went to Paris, and on the way to my first interview, I took a detour to see the place where this story all started. Lots of people wearing umbrellas, trying to stay out of the rain. Standing next to a lighting store, I think the store was destroyed in the attack. So I must be close to the synagogue. Oh yeah, here it is. It's this stone Art Deco building with a big blue door surrounded by security gates and CCTV cameras. You might not even notice it's a synagogue if you were just walking past. There's a plaque out front in memory of all the victims of the attack. 3rd of October 1980. Later that afternoon, I met up with Annette Levy-Willard at her apartment. She's the journalist who arrived on the scene of the attack just after it happened.
I can do the editing afterwards. Yeah. I can ask you what would be the right word.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was there to ask her about the night of October 3rd, 1980. But when we sat down, she told me that there was another story that she wanted to share first, a backstory. Something that happened a few weeks before the attack on Köpenick Street.
It's the beginning of September.
At the time, she was still a young reporter at the newspaper. And there was this one night when somebody phoned up the office with a tip about a secretive French neo-Nazi group called FAN.
They were called La FAN, F-A-N-E, small neo-Nazi group. Very small, I don't know, maybe 50 people, I don't know, but extreme right-wing.
The person on the phone said, this group is holding a clandestine meeting tonight, and here's the address. Annette's editor asked her to go to see if she could get them to talk and maybe there'd be a story there.
And as a journalist, I said, of course.
So that night, she showed up at the address, this shabby apartment north of the river in Paris.
So I went up the stairs, I opened the door, and I found myself with, you know, 30 guys in a small room. So these people were as surprised as I was because they were not expecting a journalist to show up at their meeting.
She introduced herself, said that she was a journalist and she wanted to write about them. To her surprise, they let her in.
And so I got my notebook. I started taking notes, you know, very professional.
She expected these men might be a little more measured in their words with an outsider being in the room. Instead, she found the opposite. They were comfortable around her.
For 2 hours, they talked about against the Jews, you know. I mean, this was real Nazism in 1980 in Paris.
In case you didn't catch that, she said they talked about gassing Jews. It was a horrifying, bad situation to find herself in. Before long, one of the men asked Annette for her full name, and she told him.
Myself, my name is Annette Levy.
Levy. A Jewish name. She felt the atmosphere in the room change.
I was absolutely scared. I mean, I was really, really scared. I was telling myself, how do I get out of there?
The way to get out, she decided, was to try and flatter the leader of the group, this guy called Mark Fredrickson.
And so I said, okay, well, now I have to go, but, you know, I would like to interview you some more. So I got out. I went down the stairs. I run, running. I went to a phone booth and I called my boss, crying. I couldn't stop crying. And you know what he said? He said, go home and write now, now, which I didn't because I was so shocked. So I went to have a drink.
Annette did get that drink and then she wrote the story. The front page headline in Libération the next day was 2 hours of hatred in France. And she told us it caused the stir because your average person just didn't know that these kinds of neo-Nazi groups existed in France. But that soon changed. A few weeks after Annette's piece came out, there was a string of attacks on Jewish institutions across the city. On September 27th, gunmen attacked a Jewish school, a nursery, a synagogue and a war memorial, with machine guns and all in one day. 2 days later, another attack on a different synagogue. In phone calls to French news agencies, all of these attacks were claimed by various far-right groups. Nobody was hurt in any of them, but it felt pretty clear to anybody paying attention that a pattern was starting to emerge.
The reason why Annette wanted to tell us all of this is because a couple hours after the Köpenick attack, a phone rang at the Agence France press offices in Paris. A staffer picked up and heard a man's voice on the other end of the line. He said he was a member of FUN and that they were responsible for the Kopernik attack. When AFP published this, Annette recognized the name FUN immediately. This was the same group she'd written about just weeks before, the neo-Nazis who held a secret meeting in that shabby apartment in Paris. She didn't buy their claim.
So, and I said, what do we, it cannot be these guys. I mean, they're clowns, okay? They can do some damage somewhere, but they cannot organize such an attack, which is very sophisticated, as you know.
Annette thought, this attack was complex, well-planned. But those guys she met weeks earlier, they did not seem capable of pulling off something like this.
Whatever Annette thought, it didn't matter. Because of that phone call to AFP, the story had taken root. This attack was the work of the far right. Newspapers published it. Politicians made statements condemning neo-Nazism in France. They promised retribution. And over the next few weeks, police arrested 83 members of FAN and people who sympathised with them throughout France.
And huge march against the extreme right wing, against fascism, huge demonstration.
Tens of thousands of people poured out into the streets of Paris in solidarity.
Manifestation spontanée hier vers 22h. À Paris, des Champs-Élysées, au boulevard Haussmann, 3000 personnes environ avec...
There were offices and factories and high schools that let people out early, so their employees and students could go to the protests. For a few days, it felt like the whole country had come out to stand alongside the Jewish community. And as protesters marched, the police started work, trying to figure out who was behind the attack.
Can you just introduce yourself, tell me your name and who you are?
My name is Jacques Poinas. In 1980, I was a junior superintendent in the Brigade Criminelle, which is the homicide division in the Paris police.
Jacques was one of the first people to arrive at the scene of the attack. He saw the destruction the bomb had left behind, the burnt-out cars, the bodies covered by sheets. And amongst the chaos that night, his job was to start looking for clues. One of his first discoveries came a few days later. The police had offered compensation for any vehicles that were destroyed in the bombing. But no one stepped forward to claim a motorcycle that was parked right in front of the synagogue. Jacques spoke to us in French while our colleague Catherine translated.
Et la première chose qui nous est apparue évidente, c'est que l'engin était disparu.
And the first thing that seemed obvious to them was that the bomb was placed underneath a motorbike that was almost destroyed, but not entirely.
Cette moto était partiellement détruite. La plaque...
Given where the motorcycle was lying on the street and the way it was ripped apart, investigators deduced that the bomb must have been attached to it. The explosive was 10 kilograms of a material called PETN. Despite how wrecked this motorcycle was, the police also managed to find a serial number on the bike.
Il y a plusieurs emplacements d'Europe. On a retrouvé un autre emplacement après où était notre numéro.
From the serial number, they were able to track down the dealership where the motorcycle was purchased. Jacques and his team visited the store.
Et donc évidemment, nous nous rendons sur place. Une équipe va tout de suite sur place.
The people there that they spoke to said that the motorbike had been sold secondhand in the shop.
The shop workers remembered the guy who bought it.
They said that he was a guy who spoke good French, but the way that they described him, he was kind of Middle Eastern.
They remembered him well enough to describe what he looked like to the police.
The first thing that was interesting was that he paid for it in cash, in dollars in particular. The employees asked him for ID because of the fact that he was paying in a different currency. It was a bit strange.
The man paid $1,000 for the motorcycle, in cash, using $1,000 bills. And he gave the address of the place he was staying at, Hotel Celtic, about a 15-minute walk from Kopernik Street. He also handed over his passport for them to see. It was a Cypriot passport, under the name Alexander Panadriou. The employees of the store also noted that he was in a rush, said he'd come back in a couple weeks to finish the vehicle registration, but he never returned.
After Jacques and his colleagues spoke to the people in the motorbike shop, they had a police sketch drawn up. It's this guy with dark eyes, dark hair, a mustache. And then when they started digging further into this new name, Alexander Panadriou, they found another lead.
Nous avons appris quelques jours plus tard que Alexander Panadriou.
They then found out a few days later that Alexander Panadriou had been arrested for stealing in a shop in Montparnasse.
Montparnasse, a neighborhood in Paris.
Il avait été interpellé.
Essentially, he was stopped by the security guard. They had a scuffle. The police were called. His passport details were taken, but then he apologized.
He tried to explain that he'd stolen the cutters because he didn't have any francs. And it was just a minor offense, so they basically let him go with a slap on the wrist.
Et donc finalement, il a été laissé libre parce que le vol était minime.
But in that process, obviously, he'd been seen by several police officers, and all of their descriptions of him corroborated or matched up with the identikit that had already been gathered from the employees at the motorbike shop.
So now they had a rough idea of what the suspected attacker looked like. And over the next few weeks, the investigators visited the Hotel Celtic, where this Alexander Panadriou had stayed. The staff didn't remember too much, but there was another person at the hotel who did. She was a sex worker who used to pick up clients in the hotel's bar. And she thought that maybe this guy had been one of her clients the night before the attack. She described him as in his 30s, maybe Arab or maybe Greek. She couldn't quite tell where his accent was from. He had messy black hair, brown eyes, short mustache, no glasses, but a vacant look in his eyes that made her think maybe he needed them.
Le fait, elle a ajouté le fait qu'il était circoncis et donc et qu'il avait payé en dollars. Et si vous voulez donc,
she added the detail that he was circumcised and that he paid in dollars. And again, that seems just unthinkable that a terrorist would think of in the night before committing a terrorist attack having sex and feeling very relaxed about it.
Again, he paid in dollars. And there was one more clue they found at the hotel. A form that the suspect had filled out in his own handwriting when he checked in. He'd written just five words. Alexander Panadriou, Larnaca, Cyprus, technician.
The police's investigation into the far right had hit a wall. All 83 far right members that were arrested after the Copernic attack had solid alibis and were later released. And when Jack and his team put together the other clues they had, the witness statements and the way the attack was carried out, they realized something. This theory that had gripped the entire country, that the attack was an escalation from smaller neo-Nazi activities in the months prior, was probably wrong. Maybe Annette Levy-Willard was right in thinking that far-right groups like FUN were not organized enough to pull off this kind of attack.
Quelque chose qui ne collait pas bien avec la piste d'extrême droite déjà et qui nous orientait évidemment vers le Moyen-Orient.
That was when the direction of the investigation started turning away from the far right and towards the Middle East.
Now that investigators had identified this so-called Middle East theory, it felt like they had a solid direction to head in. So they pivoted. Across France, the police launched a manhunt to try and find this guy, Alexander Panadriou. But a few days later, Cypriot authorities came back to them with an update. The passport was a forgery. With this news, what had been the most solid lead for French authorities evaporated, and the perpetrator of the Copernic bombing remained at large.
Eventually, the news cycle moved on, and the Copernic case slipped quietly onto the back burner. This feeling that Pascal and other survivors felt, that they'd been attacked by an invisible enemy, it stayed with them for decades. They felt forgotten by authorities.
Until 27 years later, when a new investigator entered the picture. He was young, ambitious, and determined to bring the case back from the edge of oblivion.
My name is Trevidic, T-R-E-V-I-D-I-C, Mark. I am a French judge. We never abandon a case, we never stop. That is important. It shows the importance of the fight against terrorism. You can have doors opened many years after the attack.
Mark Trevidic pried open doors that had been shut for decades, and the investigation into the Copernic bombing resumed in full force.
coming up on the Kopernik Affair.
Yeah, I mean, it was really astonishing. And in a way, we were also happy that they tracked down the guy who actually planted the bomb.
I believe that I put a man's life, not just necessarily at risk, sitting in a jail cell, but turned his life around in ways that are unimaginable.
The same day he was arrested, an FBI agent knocked at my door here in California.
So can you introduce yourself?
Oh, Hassan Diab. It was a surrealistic story, put it this way.
The case will bury us all. It's just never going to go away. We're going to have this thing till the day we die.
The Kopernik Affair is a production of Canada Land in partnership with House of Many Windows. The series is written and produced by me, Alex Atak, and Dana Balut. Our editor is Julie Shapiro. Additional production by Noor Azriye. Additional research, production, and translation support by Catherine Bennett. Sound design and mixing by Resonant Fields Audio. Original music by The Tiebreakers. Our artwork is by Tony Wong. Our executive producers are Jesse Brown and Julie Shapiro. And Jesse Brown is CanadaLand's publisher and editor.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news. We will be mostly talking about Trump's shocking and totally predictable victory, as seen from Canada. Wait for that. Lisa Goldman, Europe editor at New Lines magazine, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Listeners will remember that you previously reported on Israel-Palestine for 12 years, and you were a member of the core team that founded 972 Magazine, an Israeli-Palestinian media cooperative, but now you're based in Montreal. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Lisa, I don't think that many Canadians were watching CBC News on election night. That's a great night for CNN's numbers when it comes to Canadian viewers, maybe Fox News, the big networks in the States. Our producer, James, watched CBC's coverage of the U.S. election, so we did not have to. And here's a little taste of what it sounded like.
Well, when you're in your home and you smell smoke, you look, stick your head out the window to see if your neighbor's house is burning down. So the neighbors are up to something. And so that's why, as Canadians, we care very deeply to figure out, is something on fire, Rosie?
Yeah, not yet, but that's what we're watching for.
There was a white power element to that.
Yeah, they were certainly hoping this day would be known as Rovember the 5th. We'll see. We'll see about that. With Musk's relationship with defense contracts in the U.S., but also his relationship with Russia and China and
that the Democratic Party has moved too far, yes, to the left, that they are no longer representing the vast majority of Canadians, of Americans.
Interesting.
It's late. Same thing here.
I'll reluctantly quote John Kay here, who remarked, personally, I think it's adorable that CBC still thinks it should have its own little U.S. election show. Corey Morgan said, probably the last U.S. election the CBC will exist to cover anyway. Ouch. To watch this, it's a real stark contrast to the high production value whiz-bang graphics of the American coverage. It's just like Rosie Barton and crew sitting around a table. There was like a Democratic strategist and a Republican strategist. And if these two talking heads can't get work on American cable news on election night, I think they're not like the most in-demand pundits.
Oh, having watched the clips that you sent me, I would heartily agree.
What did you make of what you saw?
Oh, it was, okay, I will try to be judicious here. It was appalling. It was really absolutely appalling. First of all, those Dem and GOP talking heads that they had on were just, you know, blatant shills. Even when the GOP strategist spoke, and, you know, besides the fact that they were normalizing Trump, treating him as though the man actually had real policies.
He's a results-driven guy. He wants a good economy. He wants good foreign relations, no new wars. I think that's where his focus will be.
You know, the GOP guy just sort of dismissed commentary about Musk's business connections with Russia and China and said, no, he's just a great businessman. These things aren't true.
I think tens of millions of Republicans and others would say that Elon Musk single-handedly, you know, saved free speech by buying Twitter and allowing it to not be censored. So, yeah, he's a complicated guy. He's landing rockets. You know, he's an incredibly smart entrepreneur.
And there was zero pushback from the CBC people around the table. They have to challenge him. I mean, the man was just overtly lying, and yet they just sat there and smiled benignly, let him finish his sentence, and then just moved on. There was just no pushback whatsoever. I found that quite shocking.
It was sad. The CBC coverage was sad. It's like they're performing some kind of ritual that they kind of feel beholden, and everyone kind of forgets, why do we do this tradition? What is this thing? Like, well, we can't not have election night coverage, so we know that we're the last choice for most people, but that some people will still show up. I think that they would defend themselves in having those voices, those strategists, because all the big American broadcasters also have absolute partisan hacks on, and something about the way that they're just constantly rotating from person to person, but then, you know, polls are closing here, and let's look at this map here, and we've got these graphics you kind of forget, but something about them just sitting around the table. The Republican goes off and just says a bunch of stuff like that, and nobody says anything. And then Aisha Mills, the Democratic shill, talks kind of just the usual stuff, Trump and white power, Trump's like Hitler.
You're talking about the propaganda campaign and the playbook of Trump. This is not new. This is not surprising. This is directly out of Hitler's playbook. This is out of an autocrat playbook.
And conservatives online are getting very mad at the CBC that that's just like, okay, yeah, here's just some yammering about how evil Trump is that there's no pushback on. I wasn't appalled that these views got aired as much as I was just depressed at the whole spectacle of it. Like, it felt like the saddest job. I've been on election night teams, you know, and I was on CBC Radio's National Election Night radio team for the 2008 U.S. presidential election. And it really was just like a duty of service. Like, we're the last place that most people are going to get their election night coverage from. But there's some truckers and people driving who just want to know what's going on. So let's just do our jobs and tell people what's going on. It still felt like we were doing it for a reason. And watching this performance on CBC, it felt like everybody would rather be at home watching CNN than covering it themselves.
That's actually such a terrible, sad indictment of our national broadcaster. When I was growing up in Canada, and again, you know, most of my perceptions of the Canadian media environment come from my childhood before I left Canada at the age of 17 and didn't come back for 33 years. During the 33 years I was absent, things really changed. You know, when I was a kid, the CBC, had a lot of gravitas. They had really smart people. Yes, it was all white men and undeniably a problem, huge problem. We had with the Fifth Estate and we had serious news presenters and serious news analysts, and their perceptions of the U.S., their analysis of U.S. politics from the Canadian insider-outsider perspective was valuable.
It was. And you know, all respect to people like Barbara Frum, they were, for their time, they made some progress here and there. But it was very much a broadcaster of its era, but it was a serious broadcaster of its era.
That's just no longer the case. They're not offering any new insights. And you know who I turn to now for really smart analysis from an outsider's perspective is the British media. The Guardian is excellent on U.S. politics. Excellent.
Yeah. And kind of reminds us of what we once had. It almost feels like mean to keep punching at them, and who even was paying attention that night anyhow. I'm a bit more focused right now, given what happened with this election, on the months of coverage that I think gave Canadians a very different idea of what was about to happen. And what is the repercussion? What is the accountability for that? You know, Norman Spector, who's been on the show before, he posted, if media operated like other businesses, a lot of pundits and analysts on both sides of the border would be losing their jobs today. What is he talking about? Well, let's revisit some of the Kamala hype. I have to wonder, again, the media, whose job it is to tell people what is, not what they'd like things to be, how much of the desire crept into the coverage. Just looking back here, the Globe and Mail, welcome to Kamala Land. In our home base of L.A., excitement for the Harris campaign is infectious. Republicans can't land a punch on Kamala Harris, wrote the Globe and Mail. Kamala Harris is pushing Biden-onomics, but with feelings, and it just might work. Over at the Toronto Star, this is the real reason Kamala Harris is the nightmare candidate for Donald Trump. Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump was like watching Socrates debate Scooby-Doo. Here's CBC, as it happens in September, said Kamala Harris will win. says man with near perfect record of predicting U.S. elections. A little bit less perfect since then. Even as the Kamala hype was dying down, Globe and Mail said Kamala Harris finds the closing arguments that she needed. This was like right before election night. Globe and Mail, on the ground with Kamala Harris's campaign in Pennsylvania, I found reason to hope. You would be forgiven as a Canadian newsreader for thinking that she was a lock, reading those headlines.
First of all, I want to ask seriously, did you read any of the coverage from the right-wing media in Canada, like the National Post or the Toronto Sun?
They were not Kamala fans.
Uh-huh.
I think that they were critical of her, and I was following their coverage through the months, and I read it more as them taking shots at her than the more reality-based, what are the polls actually saying?
I would say that, you know, what you're doing is you're quoting to me from Canada's, you know, most venerated media outlets, which do tend to take a liberal perspective. And I think that's because Canada's establishment is pretty much a liberal establishment. I mean, that's changing. And of course, there are pockets where that's just not true, like in Alberta. But generally, just as the U.S. establishment is mostly conservative, the Canadian establishment is mostly liberal. And I mean, small L liberal and small C conservative. So I think that the main newspapers, the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star, reflect that sort of national Weltgeist or Zeitgeist.
CBC as well.
Yeah, and the CBC. And I really don't have a big problem with that. The U.S. media was a disaster in its coverage as well. The New York Times was all off. I mean, not talking about the investigative stuff. I'm talking about the commentary and the analysis. Even Nate Silver wrote, it's a dead heat. So I have no idea who's going to win, but let me just go with my, he actually wrote, like, let me just go with my gut here. My gut says it's going to be Trump. Okay, his gut was right, but it wasn't scientific.
And he's Mr. Numbers. He's Mr. Stats, yeah.
Exactly. And so, and I think there's another factor that we have to take into account, which is the huge shock of the 2016 election results, which the polls did not predict. And I think since the 2016 elections, which the polls were just flat out wrong about, people don't trust polls.
Do you remember the slew of headlines after 2016 that this is going to be a reckoning for the media and we just, like, the media has just fallen completely out of line, not just with their audience, but with reality?
I remember very well.
That was the narrative. And if they want to have any relevance whatsoever, they're going to have to, like, really have a soul-searching moment. And I think that was true.
And they didn't do it.
And we didn't do it. And the relevance of the media has degraded demonstrably since 2016. It's just, we will not learn that lesson. And we won't learn it. Listen to this. Here, even after it happened, here's a piece in the Star, opinion piece. One big winner of the U.S. election, Justin Trudeau. What? Here, I'll read. Team Trudeau could take inspiration from Jean Chrétien, who proved that being critical of the U.S. government, even the sitting president, can prop up your support at home. With Trump's election, Toreador Trudeau now gets to protect Canadian water, fight for dairy farmers in the coming trade negotiation, and shield Canadian women from the overarching influence of Republican legislators. It's hard to believe it was only a few days ago that a cabal of grumpy Liberal caucus members were calling for Trudeau's resignation for fear that he had no viable path to political salvation. I guess they were wrong. Matt Gurney said it, this is delusional. First of all, Trump makes Poilievre look more normal, not scary. And second, the Liberal Party is already exhausted and overstretched. Their lives just got way harder with Trump as the incoming president. The idea that this is good for Trudeau, it's magical thinking beyond C.S. Lewis magic. Like, this is not good news for Trudeau.
I would agree. It's not good news for Canada. Tariffs is very bad news, considering that the U.S. is by far Canada's biggest market. You think inflation's bad now? Wait until the tariffs start.
It's bad in very practical, policy-based and economic ways. And I think it's bad for candidates like Trudeau. All right, after the break, we're going to talk about what kind of candidate on the left could possibly land a punch against a candidate like Donald Trump. Let's look forward a little bit here, Lisa. The next candidate in the U.S., the next Democrat who may actually have a hope in hell of standing up to, like, I mean, theoretically Trump can't run again, but who knows? Whether it's Vance or Trump or a Trump-like candidate, it will not be another Kamala Harris-type figure. It will not be another polished and scripted Ivy League moderate who lectures the public about the MAGA threat to democracy. That strategy just failed miserably. Like, the big assumption that they made, and the Daily had a good piece about this, is they thought that Americans really were with them on caring about democracy and rule-based order. The next Democrat who actually can land a punch, will be very different. Like, if the person in charge, if the president doesn't play by the rules, then you can't expect the underdog to say, well, I'm going to play by the rules, even if the boss doesn't, because then as a certainty, they're going to lose. And I think that's going to be true here, too. Like, after Polyev is prime minister, which I think is more or less a lock, I'm going with my gut.
Please stop saying that. You're making me stressed.
Who are the Liberals going to put in, or the NDP, who's going to be able to land a punch? What this is going to do is open the door to loud, opinionated, rude candidates from the left. You're going to see politicians who sound a lot more like, I mean, I guess like me, which is not good for democracy. Like, this is
Jesse,
not
that's what, the most self-deprecating thing I've heard you say.
It's very bad. I have a number of comments, Lisa, where I'm trying to rule out even the possibility that I ever go that route, because I don't want it for myself and I don't want it for this country. And I'm not saying that I think it's going to push the left policy-wise to the left, because Trump has just proven that the policies don't matter. He won by rejecting decency and by rejecting political norms, and by seeming like a legitimate, authentic voice of grievance, revenge, and anger. And I think that that's what politics is going to be. And the left is going to figure that out. So the idea that, like, this is great for people like Trudeau is a fantasy.
First of all, I don't think we know exactly why Trump won quite yet. I listened to, I'm actually really waiting for some solid analysis. The hot takes have been overwhelmingly bad. You did refer to The Daily. I find The Daily is generally very milquetoast, but they had Astead Herndon on. He's been covering
the US. Yes, that's who I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yes, I know that's who you're thinking of, because it was such a shock to finally hear somebody on The Daily express a strong, well-informed opinion with the appropriate tones of outrage.
Joe Biden's refusal to do what he implied he would do in 2020 and transition to a different type of generation, allow Democrats to have a broader conversation about change, allow Democrats to be freed from the status quo, is not what happened. I think it would be easier for me to say that Donald Trump completed this mass realignment among the working class if we had a universe where the Democrats had a primary, where the Democrats nominated a candidate that was based around some set of ideas, and it was not tied to this administration so clearly and the status quo. But since that is not what happened, I think it has made the Republican ability to be the agents of change so much easier. The biggest thing, in my opinion, that happened was they tied themselves to an unpopular administration and with it, the status quo.
That did not represent change.
And there was a lot of evidence that that was a bad idea.
I think that Astead Herndon has like proved himself just with that short clip on The Daily. He proved himself at probably one of the New York Times' most astute analysts of U.S. politics. Like, he really knows what he's talking about, and the man's on the ground. He's also a black man. Him coming out and saying, you know, that the candidate that most blacks wanted to see elected was not the right candidate, that was gutsy of him as well. And I really appreciate that. And he also said something very smart, which was that the Dems did not address the issues that were really driving voters, which were bread and butter issues, which is what they usually are. But, you know, the fact that inflation has made the cost of food more expensive since the pandemic is a very, very big deal in a country where 60% of the population lives from paycheck to paycheck. And Kamala Harris did not address that.
I think that the extent to which this was, what does your rhetoric have to do with the price of bread, was a massive factor in this.
I agree with you 100%. And there was a huge, huge, huge miss. Trump didn't address that either, but he's entertaining. He's an actor. And Trump validates people's worst instincts. You know, people say, well, you can't talk like that. That's not politically correct. And Trump said, oh, you can talk like that and you can be president.
Well, let's talk about this question of political correctness. And here I will turn to the National Post with, I think, some other false conclusions from what happened. Kelly McParland wrote, message to Democrats, cut the toxic wokeness, that this was a victory against wokeness, which is the same thing we're hearing from Rebel News. This was a global turning point against wokeness. America has rejected wokeness. I want to explore this idea that this was a battle between Trump and wokeness, and Trump won. Like, what does a woke person believe if you're quote unquote woke? Like, if you believe that America should not be crusading around the world on like imperial colonial adventures and forcing its will upon other countries, that's what Trump thinks. You know, if you believe that our systems are corrupt, there's bias in our systems, they're rigged, and the rules are written by the elites to favor the elites, and so rather than play by the rules, let's burn it all down and make new systems, that is what Trump thinks. And if you don't like globalization, that's what Trump thinks. if you think that the press is not the voice of the people and they hide behind, you know, oh, freedom of speech, press freedom, but really they're just the voice of the establishment, that is what Trump thinks. So that worldview, that philosophy has won. I think that what lost here was small c conservatism, a concept that our institutions are really important and they'll never be perfect. It's sort of like an erroneous liberal idea that we can make things utopian and perfect and we should instead be conserving the rule of law and order and slowly making progress and trying to make a rules-based system more equitable for everybody. Like, that's what lost here.
I think you're right in saying that the rules-based system is no longer resonating with the majority of people, plurality maybe. My colleague at New Line's Danny Postel wrote a very interesting analysis of ordinary people's views on Trump and Kamala Harris. There were a lot of issues that liberal educated people don't really, they consider them already resolved in the public discourse, but for a lot of people, they're not. And in the States, especially where you have this really powerful Christian evangelical, you know, white nationalist discourse that's permeated policy and the public conversation in so many states, that might be an issue that the Canadian media is not covering with much insight based on that quote that you provided. Also, I just don't think we know what all the issues were in terms of election results.
I think there's a hopeful feeling amongst like progressives that this is going to push the Democrats to finally be an actual liberal option for people. And I understand that argument. My gut feeling is that this is not about policy or ideology as much as it's about anger. And the shiftability of a lot of people's votes, people who voted for Obama, who then voted for Trump again, you know, and then that's that younger people and racialized people are moving increasingly towards Trump. The idea that, oh, no, what the Democrats need to do is actually take much more hard positions on a lot of social justice issues. And that's going to shore this up. I don't know about that. I'm actually just completely at a loss as to what, beyond a rhetorical assault on Trump, I'm not sure what the ideology or the policy package is that takes this guy down.
There, and it seems to me, based on various sources, that people have really different, like diverging reasons for choosing Trump. I know quite a few Arab American voters who told me, you know, they don't support Trump at all, but they just cannot bring themselves to cast their vote for the Democrats. Then I spoke with quite a few people who talked about lonely young men who really responded to Trump's machismo and dominance. Of course, white women did swing toward Trump despite the decimation of Roe versus Wade. And that seems to be a race issue. Or maybe they responded to Trump saying, I'll protect you. Or maybe they believed him when he said, look, I'm sending it back to the States. I'm not going to ban abortion, but I think that should be a state issue. And then on the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC Public Radio, some Hispanic listeners called in and said that, you know, the problem was that Hispanic working class people felt that the Democratic Party only cared about black people and that they didn't care about Hispanic working class people. These are really, in a way, conflicting points of view or conflicting reasons for voting for Trump or for choosing not to vote for Trump. But it just speaks to the Democratic Party having taken its finger way off the pulse. And I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is probably very right when she says that the party has absolutely failed to come up with a credible agenda and a set of policies that will attract working class voters. I think she's probably right about that.
Well, speaking of lonely white men, here's Pierre Poilievre. Congratulations to Donald J. Trump on his election as the 47th president of the United States. We must axe the taxes, bring home our paychecks, save our jobs, stand up for Canada.
Yeah.
Lisa, we duly note things on this program to make sure that people don't miss important stories. May I begin? I've got something here to duly note.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
We often hear about government's bloated bureaucracy, that they overpay for things, that they spend taxpayer money in ways that they shouldn't. And sometimes I glaze over at these stories, but like it's often because I just don't know what things cost or what they should cost. But it's a piece in the Toronto Sun that I could relate to. Federal Liberals spent nearly $2 million to produce podcasts. Access to information requests by the Canadian Taxpayers Federation revealed that the government has been making podcasts. Who knew? Lisa, are you a fan of the podcast A-Sayers? Like, you know how Canadians say A? This is called A-Sayers.
This is the first I've heard of it. Have you listened to it? What's it about?
Well, it's produced by Statistics Canada. So you know that this is going to be a hit.
I'm already bored.
It cost over $700,000. It had 5 full-time staff members.
Okay.
All right, well, I forced James to listen to A-Sayers. So let's hear a montage of some of the highlights from this StatsCan podcast release, A-Sayers.
Welcome to A-Sayers, a podcast from Statistics Canada, where we meet the people behind the data and explore the stories behind the numbers. I'm your host, Tegan Bridge.
So often when you read about productivity statistics, it's labor productivity that they're discussing. So it's gross domestic product per hour worked.
Because graphs don't translate well to podcasting, instead, this slide whistle will give you an idea of what the graph would look like.
StatsCan spokesperson Carter Mann defended this spending and said, most episodes surpass 470 downloads within the first 7 days of release, which means that A-Sayers is in the top 10% of all podcasts.
470? About
470 downloads. It costs over $700,000. I am in the wrong part of the podcasting business. Where do I find some government work here? Oh my God.
And I actually believe in big government, and I'm a big government kind of democratic socialist, but that kind of waste is pretty appalling. Duly noted.
That's our show for today. Lisa Goldman, thank you again for joining me. It's been great both times talking to you. I hope you'll come back. Where can people find you?
I write for a magazine called New Lines Magazine, newlinesmag.com. So you can scroll down to the bottom where it says staff. You'll see me with my little drawing, a little avatar and bio blurb, and you can click on it and read all the articles I've written for them. You can also find me on X, although I'm hoping to sort of move over to Blue Sky pretty soon, at Lisa NG, LISANG. Same username at Blue Sky and Instagram.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Take care.
You can email me about today's show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins, who also did the fact-checking on this episode. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by SoCult. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, earn a ticket towards one of our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from wonderful local businesses including Harper's Burger Bar, Hotel Wolf Island, Improbable Escapes, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long & McQuaid, Martello Alley, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via cfrc.ca.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway. Join us at the Upper Hall of the Spire on Saturday, November 30th for Wrestling School of Rock in partnership with our friends at the Independent Wrestling Academy. The show is main evented by an Academy Championship match between Alexi Ormov and Geriatric. Also watch as Billy Baxter makes his professional wrestling debut against KL Shock. Proceeds from ticket sales support CFRC's funding drive. Get your tickets via CFRC.ca or IWACanada.ca and get ready to rock the Spire.
On the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic